Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. In this episode, Venkat, author of Programming Kotlin, and Hadi, a pioneer in the Kotlin community, get together to discuss all things Kotlin, along with why you should always be learning something new. Created for developers, by developers, GoTo gathers the best minds in the software community. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in Chicago, Amsterdam, and Copenhagen, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Venkat.
Hey, Hadi, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
Pleasure seeing you again.
I know it's been this is the only way we get to see each other now, huh?
You know, the last time you and I met was in the train station. You took me to the train station. I was going to go speak in a few cities in Spain, so we had a good lunch. I'd do anything to get that moment back right now.
Yeah, it's funny because I was actually driving past there the other day, and I said, I remember this. This is where we had, I think it was called Java by the Beach or something like that, the conference where you had come. Yeah, it's been so long. How is life treating you at home? Because, I mean, this is the longest ever. Like, it's the longest ever I've been stuck at home. I can't even say for you, you know.
Yeah, I came home about what looks like 10 months ago, and I'm in this beautiful basement of mine, which is where I spend most of my time these days. But it's great because I get to still interact with the world. Technology is awesome. So reaching out and speaking to developers. So it's what it is, and we have to deal with it.
Yeah. Although I was going to say, you have awesome background in your awesome views in your amazing basement, because you're actually based out of Colorado, so you got some nice mountains to begin with anyway, right?
Which has been the plus part this summer is doing more hiking now that I'm here in Colorado. Usually travel keeps me away during the summer, but you know, make the best out of what's available.
Right. And so, you know, I mean, one of the things that's always amazed me about you, well, there's many things that amaze me about you, but one of the things that I've always found intriguing is how you manage to get so much done when you're always on the road, right? I mean, when we talk with our colleagues across the conference circuit and speakers, and you've got the two broad ends of the spectrum, right? You've got the folks that if they're traveling, they don't even check their email anymore, right? Then you've got somewhere in the middle where, you know, you can travel, get stuff done, you know, write some blog posts, etc., whatever. And then you've got the Venkat on the other end, which is like, this is just my life, right? I can travel and write hundreds of books while I'm traveling as well. How do you do that? Like, what is your secret there?
You know, I don't know if it's a feature or a flaw, honestly.
Yeah, but that, you said that. I didn't say that.
But in all honesty, it's really the sheer excitement, I think. This is a weakness from my childhood. I used to drive my uncles and aunts really crazy by really getting excited about stuff and wanting to do it now. You know, if I think of something, I've got to do it now. I recently came across somebody, honestly, who is that impulsive as I am. And it was just amazing to watch this. I was like, oh, this is how it feels for others when I watch this person. But that's just the weakness from childhood, I think. And so when I get excited about something, I've got to do it. And over time, I realized that, I posted a blog a few years ago. And the blog post simply said, tell me now or tell me when. And what I mean by that is, you know, we all communicate constantly and we are depending on each other. So I believe in, you know, when I see an email, I want to tell now, you know, what I'm going to do or tell when I'll do it. So it goes into my calendar, you know, hey, I'll get back to you next Tuesday and to follow up with people on the time. So it's just being more mindful of time and other people's time as much as my time as well. And that just kind of became a habit over time. Is to be focused and get things done. And to say no to certain things because we cannot simply do everything and just need to prioritize what we do as well.
And talking about putting your mind to things, I mean, you've written, how many books have you actually written, Venkat?
About 11 or so.
11 books. Okay, so and I'm not going to say I even wrote one book. Okay, I'm done. Like, so you've been writing 11 books, and now that you've been at Hope for 10 months, how many is that? 25 or 26 or something like that?
Well, thankfully, no. The most recent book was the one on DSL and Kotlin, but so only one this year.
Yeah. And DSL and Kotlin. So that's interesting because you've actually written another book about Kotlin, which is programming in Kotlin. So I got to ask you, you know, I've got so many things to ask you about this, but let's start with the question that I always ask myself. Why did you decide to write a book on Kotlin, given that you know so many other languages and you've written so books on so many other languages? Why Kotlin?
Yes. One of the things that, you know, I ask this question quite often, like, why do I want to write any book, you know, Kotlin being one of them? And this happened about maybe 15 years ago, maybe 18 years ago. I went to a good friend of mine who had written quite a number of books, and I said, hey, I'm thinking of writing a book. What do you think? Should I write a book? And his question was, how's your business? I said, my business is doing great. I don't have time. I'm busy all the time. And then he said, well, then don't write a book because it's going to take time. And one of the reasons you may want to write a book is it's a good marketing tool. It can help you to get business. But if you've got a lot of business already, why do you bother? And I said, that's a really good advice. Thank you so much for that. And I dropped the idea of writing the book. And that was before I wrote my first book. And then a few months went by, and I was sitting down, you know, in an airplane, and it suddenly occurred to me that I do want to write a book, not because I need to build a business, but I really want to write a book because there's a story to tell. And every single book I've written is based on exactly that I have a story to tell. And with Kotlin book in particular, that is absolutely true. I've known about Kotlin for a while. In fact, I remember, you know, way back several years ago, meeting Andrew Burisla in a conference, and I, you know, kind of asked the question, you know, Kotlin, you know, Groovy does this, Scala does this, you know, Ruby does this, why should I really use Kotlin? And I think he gave me a most brilliant answer, in my opinion. And he said, maybe then it's not for you. And I said, okay, well, that's a good response. Thank you for that. And I honestly did not bother much with Kotlin at that time, because to me, Kotlin was doing what I could do in other languages. And then I kind of started playing with Kotlin after that. And there are parts of Kotlin that I was playing with. And one of the things that absolutely intrigues me, and as I know it does you as well, is we don't want to just use a feature because the feature is available. We want to go deeper and understand, you know, how that actually works. And that's the part that really intrigued me about Kotlin, is I was seeing a few different features and syntax that were remarkably different from what I had been used to. And it really bothered me and frustrated me, because I want to know, A, how this works, and B, if this is related to something I've seen elsewhere, maybe in a different setting. And I remember clearly one early morning sitting and tinkering with Kotlin code, and a little light bulb goes in my head. I'm like, whoa, I understand finally how this works. And now I think I have a story to tell. And that was the moment, and I'm like, okay, I've got to write a book on this. Obviously, a blog post won't be enough, right? So I really have to write a book on this. And I got absolutely excited about this. And the minute I kind of get that kind of excitement, I have a very unstructured way of writing, and so I threw the content in there into a you know, rough draft, and I started really working on it. But I do have to say, in all honesty, had I known how much time it would take to write the Kotlin book, or how big it would end up being, I really would not have started it. So there is a bit of a benefit to ignorance here, I think, as well. And I'm absolutely thrilled that I finished writing it. But it is the biggest book I've ever written.
Wow, really?
And I don't think my publisher would have let me write it had I told them it would be about 420 pages long, because I've been asked not to go beyond 200 pages in the past. So this one just went through every stops that usually we face. It was a really exciting journey, but I don't think I would repeat that again.
Yeah. I mean, and people talk about, when I have a light bulb moment, you said instead of writing a blog post, I wrote a book. People nowadays, they're just like, let me just tweet something. And maximum, I might make a tweet thread of three tweets. But no, you go and write another book. And this brings up another interesting point, which I think is a big myth amongst people that, and by far, I'm not saying that you are not an expert at all. You know more than thousands of people combined, but there is this myth that you have to be a very, advanced expert to write a book, right? And whereas in my particular case, I don't know if it's the case for you, but I actually used a couple of books that I wrote as a learning exercise as well. Where do you stand on that?
Well, first of all, I would say one of the things I quickly realized is I would never be an expert. I don't actually believe in this term expert because each of us have a certain amount of knowledge and depth in different areas. But the amount of ignorance that we actually have, it's what we don't even know that we don't know. And one of the things that absolutely excites me is we are learners. And what could excite us more as learners than that humbling experience to wake up one morning and say, I have no clue. And I want to go and find out, why this works or how this works. And writing a book is such a humbling experience, especially when you have the experts who are there to guide you along. And I'll share with you, the most humbling experience with respect to the Kotlin book. I had, Andrew Burislav review the book. Eugene, you recommended as a reviewer, phenomenal person. And a third person was, Tom Adam from Oslo. I had met him when I was teaching courses in Oslo. And we were in a good touch with each other. And then when I realized that he was using Kotlin, I approached and said, hey, would you be a reviewer? And a few other, excellent reviewers I had for the book. And every one of them tore the book apart, every single page of the book. Things that you recommended that I include in the book, I did not even know that it exists. Is such a humbling experience when you're writing a book, and I remember explaining certain concepts, and Eugene Wood, such a patient person. There's so much to learn from this experience. He would very politely say, yeah, good try, but have you really tried this example? It doesn't really follow what you're describing here. And I'm like, oh my goodness, now I got to go back and rewrite the whole thing. And that's the fun part is we learn certain things and we develop certain perception of these features. But when somebody else refers to a certain different view, it's absolutely phenomenal to realize there's a whole part of idea I did not even know that it exists. And you kind of sit back and think about it and say, gosh, I could never be an authority on this topic. I could never be an expert. And then we get a very different perception of concepts. So today, I was looking at something yesterday and somebody was describing certain idea and I could see that there's a lot of details missing in it. And immediately my thought goes back to my own writing and a lot of details missing in it. So I think it makes us a better human in the process as well. And to your point, this is exactly what we say about not only writing a book, but speaking in a conference as well. Yeah, you don't need to be an expert to speak on a topic because, it's your journey, your experience, your pain and your recovery from it is what people want to learn from. And there are people around you to support you and fill in and help you. And that is the fun experience of writing the book is, I always, anything I do, I want to come out smarter than I went in. Yeah. And writing a book is definitely one such experience, no doubt about it.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come. I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
But it still takes a lot to, you know, especially, I mean, if you say that someone gives you feedback and that feedback implies somehow that you have to go back and maybe redo some parts. It takes a lot to not be demotivated around that. Kudos on that, because I've gone through that process, and I'm like, all I wanted to do was finish the book. And then when there was reviews, and I'm like, oh, but this would imply so many changes. How do you cope with that?
Oh, Hari, you're absolutely right. And I will definitely be honest about it. You know, I am pretty old right now. You know, over the years, having lived in this world for a few decades, we all face challenges in our lives. But if you ask me, of all the things I've faced so far, what is the one of the most painful things I would put at the very top of the line? I would definitely put book writing on it. So when writing a book, it definitely is. And it's kind of like this experience where you write your first book and you say, I'm done. I'm
never again.
And then you come back for the second one. And then you say, I haven't learned from this experience yet. This is the end. And I remember my wife actually telling me, saying, well, of all the books you have written, this one has been the most painful for you. And then she says the same thing every time I write.
Every time, right. So you've put at the top of the list writing books as one of the most painful experiences, and you've done 11 of them. And I'm guessing that you have a few more in the pipeline.
And one of the motivations really comes from the fact that, you know, you're absolutely right, you know, having to sit back and rewrite it. But I remember in one of the books I was writing, I had the courage, and this takes a while to get to that kind of maturity, I think, and I use the word courage for a reason. I had the courage to delete the chapter entirely and rewrite it 4 full times.
Wow. Which chapter was it, if I might ask?
It was, you know what I'm trying to, it was too painful that I'd erase my memory. I think it was a chapter related to where I wanted to show how lambdas can be used for bringing in recursive operations with tail call optimization.
Right.
And I had written it. It was so complex, and nobody could understand, including myself, after I've written it. And a lot of times, this happened again in a chapter on test-driven development. I had built up this example showing how to do TDD on this particular concept. And then when you finish writing it, you realize the example is not working, the flow is not good, and you delete and you start over and you start writing it. And then you come towards the end and you realize, oh my gosh, that's a much better example to use. Now what do you do? And you have a choice of saying, well, I got a better example, but I'm going to keep it. Or you say, you know, throw it away and start over. And, you know, in a way, if you really think about it, writing a book is maybe not to this, definitely not to the scale, but writing a book is like making a movie. There are parts of a movie that never get released. They are cut out. There are scenes that were filmed that are redone several times over.
Yeah.
And, in one of the books I wrote, I'm not even kidding, 4 chapters were never, ever published. And I took the time to write those 4 chapters. And during the editorial process, they said, we got to cut this book down. We got to make this smaller. So you get to pick the chapters you want to throw away. And also, when I was writing the Java book, Brian Getz, I'm very humbled, was one of the reviewers. And he had created this concept of splitterators. And here I am getting absolutely excited about splitterators. And I spent an entire section writing maybe about, 7 to 8 pages on splitterators. And here is Brian reviewing the book, and he drops me an email saying, I want you to remove that section now. And I'm like, Ryan, this is not enough. It's splitterators. Why would you not want me to add it? And he's like, because nobody in the world should be doing what you're telling. And I respect his opinion. Absolutely. He's the one who created this concept. And it doesn't matter that I took the time to write it. And I deleted it from the book because it's a concept that shouldn't be really exploited by most programmers out in the world. And that's kind of what happens when we write the book is, we are eager to publish a book, but as we begin to write the book over and over, I would say that's the part of maturity for me, is to not be eager to complete it, but to really take the time to make it a really good book based on the feedback, both from others and from myself, right? Because as you're writing it, you begin to realize how better it could be. There is a balance here, though. You know, sometimes we have this tendency not to release it, and we take, 10 years to complete a book because we want to always make it better. So we have to have a bit of a balance in there. But thankfully, there are other people like development editors who kind of check on us and say, how's it going? Are we going to get done at all? So that's definitely helpful as well.
Yeah, the peer pressure there. I mean, you've got the advantage with books as opposed to movies that you don't have to come up with a complete new plot to make a second part. You could just do second editions and third editions and fourth editions and throw in those examples, right? But it's funny that you say that the Kotlin book has come out the longest book. I guess that goes against the idea that Kotlin is a concise language, no?
Well, so I want to really, I'm glad you mentioned it. And if you don't mind, I want to ask you a question before I answer that question or continue on the conversation. I want you to educate me and others a little bit about the history of Kotlin. So where did Kotlin come from? This is a very common question I receive, and I can't think of anybody better to ask that question to. So I want to ask you the question. Help us a little bit about the history of Kotlin, and then I'll come back in and take up the conversation that we're having.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, what Breslov shared in the past is generally the origin of Kotlin, in that we were, as JetBrains as a company that does tooling, the vast majority of our code was based on Java. And we were looking for other ways to write code to make it a little bit more concise, to have access to certain features such as lambdas, which at the time weren't available. We're talking back in 2009, 2000, early 2010 when Kotlin started. And we looked at multiple languages. We looked at Scala, but we were doing tooling for Scala, and we realized that tooling Scala is not an easy thing to do. We looked at Groovy, but Groovy was a dynamic language. We're strongly biased towards typing, I would say. And then there was this effort to try and work with the names completely gone from me. What was the name of that other language, which was at the same time?
MPS?
No, not MPS. It was very similar to... I can't remember. It's been so long. It was always Scott. It was always Kotlin and the other one. That was now, I think, by Red Hat, or that they have it. Anyway, we were talking to them to try and use that, but they were not going after the modular system. They were doing their own modular system. They weren't focusing too much on the compatibility with Java. And of course, we want a startup that you could say, let's throw away 10 years of code and rewrite everything from scratch. For us, interoperability was a must. And so we said, well, why not? Why don't we try and write our own language and see how it comes out? I think the first prototypes were called Jet Language. So original. Even after a few over 2 years, I think we still had namespaces, package names with the JET prefix in there. But that eventually got renamed to Kotlin. So yeah, that's basically the idea behind it. We needed something for ourselves, which is very much in line with JetBrains of dogfooding the tools that we make out of need.
You know, that's really useful to know the history behind the language, the effort to make it more concise and more fluent. And that's one of the things that intrigued me about Kotlin is developers rarely tell me they like Kotlin. They always tell me they love Kotlin. And that really is exciting to see developers expressing such ideas about a language. And you're able to see languages like, you know, I spent years programming in, you know, different languages. I have this fascination for programming languages. And there was a time when I programmed in one language and I thought I knew everything.
Everything there is to know.
and then, of course, I learned my second language and the third language. And today I probably program in, 15 to 20 different languages. You know, what that really made me realize is I'm not good in any one of them. But having experimented with these languages, when I looked into Kotlin, it's funny when I talk to developers, they would say, Kotlin is like, and fill in the language. And I always tell them, well, that's great. You say that because you know this other language, so you're able to draw the similarity. But Kotlin has features that I've seen in Ruby and Python and Scala and Groovy and
C-Long was the other language that I forgot. Yes, C-Long.
Yes, yeah. And also Haskell and so many languages. And this is what really surprised me is here I was telling myself, Kotlin is a simple language. Kotlin is a smaller language, a concise language. Oh, I can write a book on it very easily. How wrong one could
was
be.
You?
Because every little thing you touch on, that's a 5 to 6 pages at least to spend time on. And, you know, Kotlin has some beautiful features that either don't exist in other languages or are done much better than in other languages. But one of the challenges is, what do you cover and what do you not cover in a book? And when it's a language book, you want to give enough for people to be effective with it. You don't want to write a 3,000-page book, obviously.
Yeah.
But you cannot get away with a 100-page book as well when the language is so rich. You know, for example, you are not just able to write lambdas, but you're able to inline lambdas. And that absolutely is mind-blowing. You know, I spent my youth, you probably would think twice about talking to me the next time, but I spent my youth programming in C++. And I spent my youth teaching C++ for about 15 years. And I used to spend a lot of time teaching about inlining. So when I saw inlining in Kotlin, I naturally was drawn into the idea. But yeah. The inlining in Kotlin is very different from inlining in C++. And not only that, inlining has, you know, repercussions in how you actually inline. And there's a local return versus non-local return. And the minute you touch that, 15, 20 pages later, you're like, oh my gosh. And that's how the book ends up being a 420 pages book. Is Kotlin is a simple and elegant and small language for people who don't know it. And the minute you start experiencing Kotlin, you are blown away by the sheer richness of the language. And that's the fun part of the language itself, in my opinion, is that the language has so much to give for developers. And one of the things also that excites me about Kotlin is a language that treats me as an adult. It doesn't insult me, right? It doesn't tell me, you need to know better. Here's how you do things. So it's not a highly opinionated language in that sense. Kotlin is a multi-platform, multi-paradigm language. So if I decide that imperative style code is the right code to write, Kotlin doesn't insult me and say, oh, you should be writing functional code. Yeah. Instead, it makes that journey really enriching. And if I decide that I want to write functional style code, it makes that journey pleasant as well. So it feels like a nice adult, a good friend to work with, where they don't preach you, this is the way to do things. Instead, they say, if that's what you want to do, let's make it even better than what you could do otherwise. And that's really the story I wanted to tell in the book, is to say, hey, this is actually a really powerful language. It's not just another Groovy or Python or Ruby or fill in your language. It is a language that has taken these great ideas, but it really delivers it with a greater fidelity, if you will.
Yeah, and the whole functional and object-oriented paradigm is also, I always say that when I'm giving a talk on Kotlin, I ask the audience, I say, are you object-oriented programmers by and large? And if they say yes, I say, well, Kotlin is an object-oriented programming language. It's with functional programming features. And if it's a functional audience, I say, well, Kotlin is a functional programming language with some object-oriented programming features. But what would you say is kind of like the biggest thing that you learned from the book, from writing the book? Like, what's the biggest takeaway? Other than, okay, this was a really long book.
it is really taking the time to learn about ideas to a greater depth than what I think or thought I knew. I came into, there's a certain amount of learning that happens for no matter which book you write, like we talked about earlier. But with Kotlin, the language is evolving as well. And as I came in, it's not just writing about the language itself. It's writing about the different paradigms. It's writing about coroutines is such a beautiful concept. And coming in, I would say probably I knew, if I were to put a number, I would say, okay, if I want to really praise myself, I would say maybe I knew 70% of the things in there. But knowing the depth of the things and beginning to realize, seeing things in a different light than I saw them before was the most rewarding experience for me. I say my job, often I describe as, my job is that kid in the candy store. That's what I love about what we do, right? You're never old when you're in this field. I am waking up with excitement today as I did 30, 40 years ago. And the reason is, it's such a wonderful experience to come in knowing certain things and ending the day knowing a lot more than you did.
Yes,
and
totally.
This book was definitely that for me. I came in knowing certain things, but thanks to the reviewers of the book, thanks to experimenting deeper with some of the ideas, I came up with a much better learning of Kotlin than I started with. Yeah. And to me, there are two reasons I want to write a book. You know, I said I want to write a book for telling a story, but the two real important reasons we want to write a book is you want to learn from that experience. It's the most rewarding aspect of writing a book is you come back saying, wow, I really understand this a lot better than I thought I did. And the second is to help somebody else go through that journey. Somebody reading the book, looks back and says, whoa, that gave me a different perspective than I started with. And to me, that's the most humbling experience for me is when I travel around the world, I would be in an airport or a conference or even in a restaurant. And somebody would just walk in and say, hey, I read your book and it really helped me to write better code in this particular language. And to me, that is the most rewarding experience is somebody saying that they read your book and learned from it and they applied it. That's all your intention is. And I would say I'm that first student of my book because as I'm writing the book, I'm saying, oh my gosh, I'm learning in this process already. It is already serving a purpose. And I would say definitely about Kotlin. There are such a amount of misunderstanding I had about a certain number of features in Kotlin that really came to light as I was writing the book. And to me, I'm absolutely thankful for that is because now I have a much better appreciation for both the language and the authors behind the language. In fact, I want to share that experience with you. I was in St. Petersburg a couple of years ago to speak at the conference over there, the Joker conference. And I was tweeting about it, and you mentioned, hey, since you're in St. Petersburg, do you want to go hang out with the team? And I would say that was an amazing experience for me. I finished speaking at the conference, and I went to your office in the evening. This was a Friday, and I showed up like 4:30 in the evening. And I get to spend, you know, a few hours. I think I was there till like 7:30 p.m. or so, speaking to different groups that were working on things. And, you know, what blew my mind really was, I've spoken to a lot of different, authors of languages and frameworks and tools. And to a great degree, when you're an author of something, it's kind of like your baby. And it's natural to become defensive about it. What I really enjoyed about the team I met in St. Petersburg office of JetBrains is they were not there to defend their decisions. And I would say something critical about, you know, why would this behave like this? Why wouldn't it be different? And rather than saying, well, you don't understand this or you're wrong. And they were like, well, there is some truth to it, but here's what we are doing to address it. And they would go into the depth of explaining why decisions were made the way they are, but how they are reevaluating it and how they are constantly learning from that experience. And Andrew, said, you know, I'm not here to, and his, the foreword he wrote in the book was the most amazing in my opinion, because when I read this foreword, I almost had tears in my eyes, because here's an author of a language not telling you, hey, I know what I'm doing, you better use it. And instead, his words were the most humbling words I've seen, saying, well, we made these things based on what we know at the time, but I'm not going to tell you that these are the right things ever. And we are constantly learning. And his words were the true words ever spoken, in my opinion. And to me, there is a reason why this language is really awesome. It's because the people behind it are awesome. And that's what really blew me. So if you ask me, what did I learn from the experience of writing this book is the human aspect of it more than the language, in my opinion, is to know that there are people behind these languages who are genuinely interested in learning and furthering the field. And that is a very humbling experience to watch that and say, wow, such humanity, such humbleness, such eagerness to learn and excel. Those are the qualities I want my own children to have, if you will. And that's what we want to really see in this world.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I'll make sure to pass the message, although they'll all probably watch this. But it definitely makes my life as a developer advocate easier as well, right? Because part of our job is to go and give feedback and say, well, people are using this product, this tool, this language, and there are these issues. And they're always very, very open to listening and receiving feedback. But let me, you know, we're kind of running out of time. But I want to wrap up with something that I think that you're very qualified to answer here. You know, you've written books on so many different languages, from Java, Ruby, JavaScript, Kotlin, anything, you name it. Now, a lot of people come and say, they would say that in the past as well, like Java is getting X and Y feature. How does Kotlin stand now? You know, what is Kotlin going to do now that we have this feature or whatever feature? Now, I've got my own opinions on that, but I'd like to know what you feel is the place for Kotlin in the future.
So I see languages as vehicles, and certain vehicles are better for transportation in a certain situation. A bicycle versus a car versus an airplane or a helicopter. So Java has definitely its place in the enterprise. There's no doubt about it. But one of the beautiful things about the Java ecosystem is that it is a polyglot environment. And so if a team is really comfortable using Java, good news is Java is changing. So Java is innovating. And so you can continue to use Java. But the beauty of languages like Kotlin is for teams that can adopt to using different languages on the virtual machine or elsewhere, I think they have a good number of choices, Kotlin being definitely one of them. But I would say there are three places where I find that Kotlin is really suited for teams that want to embrace yet another language in their environment. And the first is, obviously, this is the kind of probably the most basic answer is Android development. So if developers are programming for the Android, Kotlin is, I would probably not be wrong saying it's the de facto standard today, is to use Kotlin for Android. So that's kind of a very obvious answer. And when I work with my clients around the world, I often, try to understand what language they use. And almost always the answer is we use, Kotlin and we're doing Android development. But from the point of view of conciseness and elegance and expressiveness, and also to reduce errors, you were mentioning about how you're keen about static typing. That's one of the things that really intrigues me is if I want to really create DSLs, this is one of the reasons I wrote a book on Kotlin with DSL is, I've been intrigued by DSLs for a while. And in all honesty, I love Groovy for its ability to create DSLs. But being a dynamically typed language, it really gives you a double-edged sword, which is powerful, but you got to be very careful with it. So the smartness of type checking and early errors that you get out of Kotlin is really useful because it reduces the errors much more quickly. I'm a huge fan of writing automated tests, don't get me wrong, but I'm not going to say I would rather write more tests than have compiler support when I can have the best of both worlds. And Kotlin, I think, hits that sweet spot really nicely for me. And even, things like Spring have such a great amount of fluency for writing Spring applications. So if you're on the server side, you can still benefit from that as well. But a third place where I think Kotlin is a really great opportunity is, oftentimes a lot of us approach Kotlin from the point of view of Java and the JVM. But Kotlin itself is not a language that's restricted to the JVM. Way back in time, Scala was originally created as an implementation that runs both on the .NET platform and on the JVM. A lot of developers new to Scala may not realize it today. When F# really gained prominence on the .NET platform, Scala kind of withdrew from the .NET platform and it focused mostly on the JVM. Well, Kotlin actually is broader than that scope. You could write Kotlin, that's why it's a multi-paradigm, but also multi-platform language. Yeah. If you're writing Kotlin native versus Kotlin for Android versus Kotlin for the JVM versus Kotlin for the browser, or if you want to write for WebAssembly. So Kotlin actually gives you probably this one language that rules the world, if you will, because you could be, I'm not suggesting you should, but you could be writing Kotlin for different platforms, if you will. One of the companies I came across recently decided to implement Kotlin for validation of business rules, both on the server side and the client side by writing those logic in Kotlin and then compiling it to the bytecode on one side and JavaScript on the other side. So those, once you get exposed to it, there are so many places where we could actually exploit it.
Yeah, and I think that, for me, one of the things that coming from a background of writing native code, right? I mean, I did C, C++, and then Delphi. I don't know if folks know what Delphi is, but definitely, it was a lot of my bread and butter. The attractiveness of having Kotlin native compiled to native platforms and having it on Linux, Windows, Mac OS is very, very cool. And I think that combining that with eventually getting Jetpack Compose, which is a framework for creating UIs on Android. Now we're doing the version for desktop, although that currently runs on the JVM. I think eventually when we get that onto native, It will be fantastic. So, yeah, but cool. Well, we are out of time. It's been amazing chatting with you, Venkat. I wish that we could do this in person at some point. I really, really miss that aspect of seeing friends again and that, you know, human touch.
I see the light at the end of the tunnel. So, you know, maybe this time...
Can you tell me where the tunnel is? Because back here, I don't see that light.
Yeah, well, it's not too far. I look forward to the day. I'll sit next to you and we'll be chatting in one restaurant somewhere around the world.
Oh, I do look forward to that.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech for lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.